The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're gonna hear about it. You.
That's right, boys and girls and non-binaries. Today is Festivus for the rest of us, which means that there might be, if we have enough time, some airing of the grievances a little while later on this here Reason Roundtable podcast, whose name I can almost pronounce. Hi, everyone. I'm Matt Welch, joined on this eve of Christmas Eve by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy damned Festivus, you people.
Thank you, Matt.
Hi. Howdy.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Yeah. Donald Trump won, Peter.
Yeah.
He won. Do you understand?
He died for your right to say Merry Christmas or something.
We shall start our own lamentations here with a bit of news last week that I'm pretty sure was covered less than a joke Trump made at a rally in Michigan about a dead congressman. It is this. On Friday, the president signed into law a $1.4 trillion bipartisan budget deal, which keeps the federal government open through next September. It's a 2,400 almost page cromnibus. Lawmakers had less than 24 hours to read it before voting on it. That's, I could think you can do some math there in your brain, the per hour business. This has now become obviously an annual tradition in Washington, where in lieu of actually doing what its Congress is supposed to be doing, which from what I understand is appropriating money and directing it and having 14 separate appropriation bills get debated and marked up and then maybe voted on, and then you got to hash it out like through a conference committee and then you present it to the president. Instead of that, every year we do this thing now, which is get the leader of the House and the Senate and negotiators from the White House into the antechamber of a back room, dark room, swamp place, and then have a last ditch before vacation up or down vote that no one has time to read. And then we all spend the rest of the holidays slash year trying to figure out what god awful things were crammed into this thing, even if the lawmakers themselves knew. Nick, you wrote about this thing 2 weeks ago or so, back when it was only $1.3 trillion. Give us an overview of why you think that this is stinky.
Yeah, I'm like completely in Frank Costanza mode when it comes to the budget process in D.C. And it has been this way for most of, if not all of the 21st century, either in the early 21st century when the Bush Republicans were in charge of everything. They hit a lot of extra spending, particularly for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan through various kinds of supplemental spending bills where they didn't have to go through the regular budget process. Somewhere during Obama's years, the Senate just stopped even producing budgets and everything kind of came to, you know, these kind of cromnibus bills. It's a, for me, the real takeaway from this, and this sometimes because, you know, we're in a hyper-polarized period and everybody is like, yes, you know, we agree that, you know, Trump is terrible or the Democrats are terrible. But, you know, this is so important. We can't have time to have actual arguments about ideology anymore because we have to stop the other side. Congress is spending record amounts of money while Trump is being impeached. Polarization, we're at peak polarization. We're also at peak spending. I think these two things are very tightly related. We have a bread and circuses in America. It doesn't take place in a coliseum. It takes place in Congress and in D.C., where we have two parties that are sworn enemies that fight to the death, and yet they continue to agree on spending more and more money that we don't have on programs that we don't need. And this latest budget fiasco is merely the closest of this. And you get a thing where Trump, after the defense bill was signed, which was 780 something billion dollars, you know, we get Space Force out of that. We get paid family leave for federal workers. And, you know, Congress has also now found time to raise the vaping age to 21, because God knows you should be able to go fight in these stupid foreign wars that we can't pay for, but you shouldn't be vaping because, you know, that might really cut you you know, that might end your life a couple of years early. We really have to pull all of this back and go back to the process, Matt, that is legislated by law and is followed absolutely nowhere.
Peter, you love the Budget Control Act more than you love your dog, more than you love a good Manhattan. Why is it a dead letter? And are there any kind of technocratic, fever dream, legalistic fixes to it? Or is it just a question of kind of culture?
Okay, but I love drinking a good Manhattan while hanging out with my dog more than the Budget Act. Just
fair enough.
Individually. The Budget Act was put in place in 1974 and was designed in part to rein in executive power over the budget. It was designed to the Nixon administration was doing something called impoundment, which was basically refusing to do what Congress had budgeted. And so this act was put in place to reform the budget process and to give Congress a little bit more power over how the executive spent money or didn't. And so it created the Congressional Budget Office and also outlined the steps that Congress is supposed to go through in order to pass all of the appropriations bills and then eventually get a budget passed each year. And it has been since something like 1998, since Congress has actually gone through the entire process and done all of it in a single year on time. I'm not 100% sure about that date, but it's been about 20 years at this point. And so Congress has just decided not to play by its own rules. And in fact, the most interesting part of this deal is another instance of Congress declining to do what a previous Congress had said it should do. And so I actually want to zero in on, you'll be shocked, the healthcare provisions.
Drink.
Yes, totally shocked. The healthcare provisions in this bill that stand out are the repeal of three taxes that were included in Obamacare. The Cadillac tax on expensive health plans, the medical device tax on medical device makers, and the health insurance tax on health insurance premiums. And you might be thinking out there, wait, isn't that great that we're repealing taxes? Well, in some sense, sure, except that they're repealing taxes that were supposed to pay for Obamacare. And you may remember that there was this big debate about a decade ago when Obamacare was going to be passed about, well, you're putting taxes in place. Are they ever really going to go into effect? And the most controversial of these and the biggest revenue raiser was the Cadillac tax. The Cadillac tax, this just sort of shows you how problematic Obamacare is in many ways. The Cadillac tax was arguably the best part of Obamacare because what it did, yes, right, the whole sort of...
That's like a very upsetting
yes,
sentence
it
right
is.
There.
The whole issue with the American healthcare system is that there is a tax break for employer-sponsored health insurance. And what the Cadillac tax did was it started just a little bit to tax very expensive plans. And so the idea being that very expensive health insurance plans, you wouldn't normally get this much health insurance if everything had an equal tax status, since employers, if they give you a dollar, it gets taxed. But if they spend that dollar on health insurance, it doesn't get taxed. And so they are more likely to give you compensation in health insurance benefits. And so the idea was, well, let's rein that in just a little bit. But who doesn't like that? Well, who has very expensive health insurance? Unions. And so unions fought this. And there was also Republicans didn't like it because it was a tax. And then there's the medical device tax, which Elizabeth Warren doesn't like because there's a bunch of medical device makers in Massachusetts. And so there's always been a kind of bipartisan grumpiness about these taxes. They're finally off the books. The Cadillac tax had been delayed a couple of times already. And so what does this tell you? It tells you that all of these plans to pay for stuff with a bunch of taxes that hit either middle class people or unions or industries that have legislators like Elizabeth Warren who are willing to go to bat for them, those taxes don't work. People don't like them and they don't get put into effect. And then what you have is you have the spending is still there. The taxes aren't, and a huge hole in the budget as a result. And so we already have that. And a Medicare for All plan along the lines of what Warren or Bernie want to do relies on, you know, Bernie doesn't have a complete plan to pay for it. Warren has a complete but totally fake plan to pay for it. But they rely on these types of taxes. And I think it's very likely that we would end up seeing the same sort of thing happen, which is the spending goes into effect, the taxes go into effect, but the, or the, and the, but then the taxes get repealed before before they can actually raise the money. And that's how we have the budget that we have.
Catherine, do you think that there's an offshore betting market that's dedicated to what topics will or will not be discussed on the Reason Roundtable? If so, do you think that there is a betting line on how quick Suderman is going to bring up Obamacare, regardless of whether the issue is anything to do with Obamacare? And do you think
the budget deal had a lot to do with Obamacare? It repealed several Obamacare taxes,
him,
man,
under the table.
Yeah, as we all know, Reason Magazine is, I think, affirmatively in favor of insider trading. So I am going to go locate that market and lay some bets of my own. Also, though, if there is a secondary market in me, it's definitely the Space
Force
mention. And I am about to make that bet pay off. So you can ask your question, but I'm just going to
talk about
the
Space Force. Are you in favor of Space Force, Catherine?
I am really not. Like, I am super duper not in favor of adding another branch to our armed forces. Like, we're just really casually being like, yeah, sure, let's have a sixth armed force. We'll just throw it in this omnibus budget bill. What? What? This is a terrible idea. And it's also a terrible idea in that it will yield the precise opposite of the thing that it thinks it's doing. So if we are like, okay, we're going to get everybody snazzy uniforms, we're going to take a bunch of guys from the Air Force and just like put a new label on them, like fine, whatever. The jaded case on this would just be like, it's a reshuffling. People were already doing space-oriented security stuff. You know, it's just a kind of classification thing. But no, in fact, what will happen is that other nations are going to use this as an excuse to set up space forces of their own, and their space forces will have even less scruples than our space force about having fun space war because space war seems cool. And frankly, a huge part of the reason that we go to any kind of wars is because people like the idea of war. People tell pollsters that all the time. American presidents get a bump when they go to war. Imagine the bump from space war, guys. This is going to be the waggiest of dogs. It is going to be a nightmare. It is going to be expensive. It is going to be inefficient, and it is going to make for more war.
You're selling me on it now, though, because it'll take our mind off of the budget.
I made space war sound too good.
Really,
was my pitch for like space war is awesome?
But I mean, you've read Ender's Game, and the whole premise of Ender's Game is that when the buggers attacked, I'm sorry, they're called something else now, but
did they rename the buggers?
Yeah, like all the versions, they're now called something else. But when they attacked,
they're called Mormons.
We weren't ready.
Right. So what you're saying basically is like this budget bill ends in, I guess I shouldn't spoil Ender's Game. This budget bill ends in Ender's Game is what you're saying.
I'm saying that with the argument for the Space Force is
See,
that
but this
it prevents
is the problem. Again, it's
it
like
prevents the second invasion from being right. It prevents us from losing.
Yeah,
Maser Rackham is going to be
the
chairman of the Joint Chiefs
opening
of,
up, man.
Of Space
what do you
Force.
Say about the NBA?
I've been nodding off for a while, Nick.
Maybe we can somehow bring this together by talking about professional basketball and the Space Jam reboot.
Listen, this isn't like talking about basketball. It's literally weaponizing space.
Screw
you guys.
Space has always
been weaponized.
No,
I actually think that this
is the ultimate
weapon. I worry not just that there's going to be more war, but that there is going to be cool war, but that there is going to be more deadly war. And if you remember a while ago, there were reports that the military was actually developing a railgun, a space-based system to basically drop uranium rods onto the planet.
Problem. It sounds
which,
so cool.
On the one hand, sounds pretty awesome, and on the other hand, makes nuclear weapons look puny and not very effective.
Yeah. I mean, this is, in fact, what's actually going to happen is not so much death or certainly so much civilian death in the short run. Satellites are going to become more contested than they already are. And there's likely to be, I would say, a higher rate of satellite destruction and counter-destruction than we are
already experiencing. Matt, who is the Muggsy Bogues of the Space Jam cast? Who's the premier little man in today's NBA?
Kevin Hart, obviously, is the answer to all questions. Eddie Murphy's 11th son. Nick, you had a great line in your piece that I want to zero in on. to explain the import. Well, first you pointed out that that Peter's Congressional Budget Office is now
is that
forecasting.
What we're calling it?
Yes, is now forecasting the next 10 consecutive years to have annual budget deficits of over $1 trillion. Just like, okay, that's the world we live in. But in addition to that, or like these things are actually related, the CBO right now is predicting that average annual growth between 2019 and 2029, the next decade, will be 1.9%. That figure compares to 3.2% average between 1950 and 2018. Instead of telling us why that'll happen, Nick, which you can get into if you want to, but wanted you to chew on just a little bit why that matters. What's the difference between those numbers and why should we care about the difference? Because a lot of people are like, hey, look, we grow too much. That's the problem in our consumerist
society. No, it is true. You know, we're living in our little pods, you know, cars, and we're, you know, we put headphones on and we're in bubbles, Matt, and we're just eating more, you know, Dunkin' Donuts and bagels and coffee lattes. It's all just awful, right? The joke or the problem with slower economic growth is that, or rather high deficits, persistent debt and deficits decreases long-term economic growth. This is something that economists on the right and the left agree about, and I'll refer.
Although there are lefty economists who are starting to dispute it.
Yeah, I mean, and there are right winger. I mean, this is, you know, who say that, you know, debt and deficit really doesn't matter. I mean, Dick Cheney, you know, kind of capped that well, but back in the early 2000s when he said Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. In fact, they do. I think, and I think we're living that reality where the United States government has been showing absolutely no interest in curbing the growth of deficits and debt, and we are in a historically low economic growth period. The problem with that is it compounds and you have a lower standard of living over time for a variety of reasons that we can get into or not. But the difference, and Matt, I believe this was George Will had this line when we interviewed him a couple of years ago at the Students for Liberty, International Students for Liberty Conference, where he said, you know, the difference between 2% annual growth and 3% annual growth is the difference between an America that is, you know, locked into polarized, weaponized political battles, cultural wars, and things like that, because there's a sense that there isn't enough to go around. When you're growing at 2%, when you're growing at 3%, which is 50% higher than 2%, people actually loosen up a lot and they get on with their lives and people get along better because they're not worried that every crumb that you have, every pizza crust in your hand is taken from my mouth. I don't want to be a complete Marxist or Austrian school economic determinist, but I do think that a big reason why America is so fraught right now is because of a sense that the economy is not growing, the pie is not growing, and it's a zero-sum game. That's why we need to pay attention to the size and spending of government. I would also throw in a kind of overlapping argument, which is, you know, one that's based in human freedom and individual autonomy. The more that the government spends and the more it does, the less we have free rein to kind of live our lives the way we want to. Those two arguments are one of the reasons why the budget battle and the absolute abnegation on the part of or abrogation on the part of anybody in Washington to even talk about this shit anymore is really a cause for concern.
Peter, there's the common refrain, to the extent that anyone is paying attention to or criticizing the return of trillion-dollar deficits, is that, well, there you go, tax cut. That's what happens when you give a tax giveaway to the rich, like the Republicans did. Talk to us a little bit about how that's perhaps an incomplete picture, given what has grown since Trump took office.
So the deficit, as I have said many times on this podcast, is simply the difference between revenue, tax revenue collected, and spending, right? It's if you collect less revenue while spending stays the same, your deficit grows. If you spend more while tax revenue stays the same, your deficit grows. What we're doing is both. And so what has happened under Trump is that federal spending has increased. The federal budget was just shy of $4 trillion before Trump took office, and now it's about nearly $4.5 trillion. And so you combine more spending with less revenue, and you have a much higher deficit.
It is worth pointing out that we have...
deficit was just the word for things we decide to do together.
It is that.
But it's also important to note that we are pulling in records amount of revenue. So, you know, this is... And these two things, this is not an argument in favor of a supply-side tax cut, the idea that tax cuts always and everywhere pay for themselves, but we actually are pulling in a ton of money, record high amounts of revenue, but we are spending more and more. And I think we all know people who are like this, where, you know, as they make more money, as their household becomes more productive and they make more money, somehow they find themselves further in debt. I hate being around those people. They're fucking annoying. And that's the entire country, you know, nowhere. It's like, oh, you know, yeah. And again, you know, one of the great writers, you know, of the past 50 years is Tom Wolfe. And for a variety of reasons, but in his novel, The Bonfire of the Vanities, that came out in 86 or 87, just as the stock market was booming again in a way that it hadn't for 15, almost 20 years. And he talked about Masters of the Universe, the central figure in that. There's this great set piece in the beginning of the book where Sherman McCoy, the master of the universe, the stockbroker who was making money hand over fist, he kind of is explaining to himself how, despite making more and more money, he's further and further in debt. And that it's a sickness. And that's where the government is right now. And it's particularly bad because if it's your stupid friend or your sibling or your relative or whatever, you can just say, you know, shut up and do something different. It doesn't have to affect you other than giving them leftovers, you know, at Thanksgiving dinner. But when it's the country, it affects the entire economy. And we really need to be more serious about this as a country. And this is what is different now, and you know, nearly 2020 versus 10 years ago and 20 years ago and 50 years ago, is that there is nobody other than libertarians saying, you know what, like, maybe persistent deficit spending is not a good idea. But now you have Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, who is, you know, echoing fucking Dick Cheney. I mean, what, you know, what a horror show.
There are a few retiring Republican lawmakers who are saying it's a bad idea.
To that point, there was a column in today's New York Times by David Leonhardt talking about the bias of centrism, which contained points that I actually kind of agreed with, including that, you know, people who portray themselves as being centrist frequently pretend that they're not being ideological, which is a point that I've tried to make over the years. But one of the... examples that he pointed to towards, like, you know, sort of tisking at the persistent bias of centrism is like this obsession over deficits and debt. Like, that's just, you know, that's the centrist class. They won't stop yammering about this. Maybe we need to have other questions there. So, like, the last bit of flicker of this is going to be extinguished anyways. Catherine, before we leave the budget deal, I can't just not talk a little bit about, let's go ahead and raise the smoking age to age 21. In addition to doing that, Governor Andrew Cuomo of the great state that Nick and I have foolishly decided to move to tweeted over the weekend, "Trafficking untaxed cigarettes and selling tobacco to underage people isn't just unethical, it's illegal. I'm proposing strengthening penalties for retailers who break these laws at the expense of New Yorkers' health." Hi, Catherine, what do you think about that?
I kind of want to, like, parse that sentence from an editor's perspective. Like, I'm proposing cracking down. The crackdown will occur at the expense of New Yorkers' health, I think might be a way to read that. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, I'm old enough to remember, et cetera, when Republicans were against this sort of thing. I think there's probably some kind of, like, we can call it like Liz Nolan Brown's law or something, which is as soon as people start using the word trafficking, like, poor people are about to get really screwed. And that is a great, you know, this is a great example of that. Like, if we are now going to start treating the sale of previously legal, like 5 minutes ago legal substances to adults, to people who have attained majority by any other legal standard, things are going to go real bad. And they're not going to go bad for people like you and me. They're going to go bad for people who do not have access to lawyers. They're going to go badly for people who do not have otherwise good relations with law enforcement. And they are going to go badly for people that are being targeted for something else as collateral damage.
and they're freaking going to go bad for Eric Garner. You're governor of the state of New York.
Correct.
Do you remember at any time recently when there was an enforcement of selling cigarettes illegally where that kind of went pear-shaped? Does anyone remember that? Jesus Christ. The amount of like not being able to relearn recent history that blew up in your face is staggering. Anyways,
there was a shining moment when Andrew Cuomo was elected for his 10th term as governor of New York and inheriting it from, you know, with a couple of nobodies in between from his father, Mario Cuomo, where it really looked like Andrew Cuomo, you know, had been kicked out of the Kennedy family because he lost, you know, a couple of elections and was covered in shame as the HUD secretary under the Clintons, you know, where he was going to go full Oedipus and kill his father's legacy. When he became governor at one point, he said that, you know, we cannot tax ourselves out of this anymore because New York already has the highest or one of the very highest state and local combined tax burdens. We can't regulate our way out of this. We have to make America, New York, open for business. He was talking about legalizing fracking in upstate New York, which would turn it from the equivalent of East Germany into like a place that people might actually want to live. And he reneged on all of that within about 3 months of being inaugurated. And it was one of these moments, and something similar was happening with Jerry Brown on the West Coast, where Brown was not only set to dismantle his father's legacy, but his previous legacy as a governor of California. And it didn't happen. And, you know, like Oedipus is often, you know, it's rightly understood as one of the great tragedies of, you know, of literature. It could also have been a great political manual for 21st century America, where if these governors who, you know, who had Oedipal complexes had actually killed their fathers, you know, whether they want to marry their mothers, that's up to them. But they could have destroyed the, you know, bloated infrastructure programs and spending programs and tax programs and regulatory programs of great states like California and New York. And we'd be having a very different conversation. And it wouldn't be about Andrew Cuomo talking about goddamn, you know, super taxing vaping and cigarettes in a way that is just going to lead to more chaos and less revenue overall.
There's a piece in the LA Times last couple of days talking about how California in the 2020 census might end up actually losing a seat in the House of Representatives. It's like someone who grew up, was born and raised in California, it's unfathomable. A place that grew on average 2.5 to 4 times faster than the country every single decade since it was waved into existence by a bunch of yahoos in 1848 until around 1990. And now they are facing something close to, certainly stagnating population, and pretty soon it's going to be population loss, which New York also faces, population loss. We're year 9 or 10 of the boom, as we keep saying here, and you're losing population. Holy cow. Just imagine when these prices are met with recession, it's going to be a nightmare. Speaking of nightmares and Democratic politicians, we had a debate, another presidential debate last week with 7 candidates only this time. And for some reason, Tom Steyer was one of them, which is kind of bizarre. Catherine, you are been the Pete Stan among us. He took a lot of fire for various wine caves. And other thing, what I worry about with Pete, because I'm finding myself, maybe just to spite Nick, I'm finding myself enjoying his candidacy more and more. But I'm worried that I just like him in direct proportion to how much the progressive left hates him. It just hates him. Like there's so much just hate beams going onto Pete Buttigieg that I'm like, hey, that sounds pretty good. Where do you gut check after watching the debate?
Yeah, I too struggle with the kind of the enemy of my enemy problem there, especially
when
we were peak kind of Kamala versus Pete. There was a moment there when I was like, oh yeah, he must be great. And the wine caves exchange, I actually thought was really interesting and telling, mostly because what it was actually about was the should billionaires exist question, right? Like there are a bunch of other things that were going on there. And obviously the background noise of our utterly failed campaign finance reform efforts was a big piece of it. But I thought this sort of who is beholden to exactly which tiny slice of rich people sort of squabble mostly was just bad for the Democratic Party overall, right? Like the idea that they were fighting about, you know, well, everyone on stage is a millionaire and some people on stage are billionaires. And
I think Pete Buttigieg maybe isn't a millionaire. Certainly
no, so his, but that was
or,
what he
or
said,
he's
right?
Much like less of one.
His
than,
his comment was like, "I am the only person on the stage who is not personally a millionaire or a billionaire." But of course, he also kind of just temporarily isn't, in the sense that he comes from a quite well off family. In the sense that his you know, he has chosen to divert from very, very high earning professional opportunities to do politics. His, you know, he has education debt, but it's exactly the kind of education debt that actually makes a certain amount of rational sense and will, you know, pay off for him in the long run. But all of that, I think, is secondary to, you know, Elizabeth Warren saying, "I've pledged not to give rich people ambassadorships and you're meeting in the wine caves." And, you know, but then that the whole garbled selfie parable in which, you know, she's taking all the selfies, but maybe some people have to pay for their selfies, but then those people are still speaking for America. They're not like it's all in the end just about the Democratic Party's extremely uneasy relationship with wealth and the country's maybe. But in the end, it just highlighted to me like all these people rely on very, very wealthy people to fund their campaigns. And any pretense otherwise is just that. It is a pretense. And none of them are really more or less culpable than any others, and certainly no less culpable than Republicans, if you think that's a bad thing.
But there's also this odd form of mistaken thinking built into the Warren part of this argument, which is that rich people can buy you a winning election. And Tom Steyer was on that stage, and he pretty much, I think it's not quite that he just paid a purchase price, but he pretty much bought himself onto the Democratic debate stage. But he is not going to be the Democratic nominee.
So, but let me ask you this.
He's not going to be president.
I have
he's
long
not
said.
Get, he's a billionaire with effectively unlimited resources, and so is Michael Bloomberg.
Right.
And neither of them are going to be successful.
Let me ask, though. I have said this for a long time. I have said, like, if there is one lesson that you can tell from all these billionaire douchebags that think they can buy themselves the presidency and then wash out, it's that, hey, maybe it's actually not so easy to buy an election. But Bloomberg standing in the polls is making me just a little bit nervous about continuing to make that claim. Should I be strong in my convictions? Like
you
his current
be
standing
in
the
your,
polls is not
in your conviction. But also remember, Michael Bloomberg was mayor of New York, and he is not just a billionaire businessman. He is a politician with a substantive political
I
career.
I mean, this season has Trump already like chewed up and spit out other mayors of New York. So,
but Trump didn't dump
no,
all his
I
money
agree.
On it.
Trump
all right?
was
like
smart. He got other yeah. people, and
in fact,
including the media.
Hillary Clinton outspent yeah. Trump by a considerable amount in the 2016 campaign.
For anybody who makes less Catherine, than $1 million a year, the distance between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump is effectively zero.
The Catherine, the way that you should stay strong is that I don't have the numbers in front of me, but Bloomberg has spent like $100 million already in this campaign. He's spent a staggering. Him and Steyer have outspent the rest of the field combined by a factor I would be confident in saying is like 20 to 1 or maybe even more. And that has bought them all the way to, you know, Steyer is polling below 2%. And Mayor Mike is, I agree, 5%
well,
is pretty
know,
shocking.
The larger,
shocking.
There's two other points here. One is like, is the billionaire class, you know, are their interests completely at odds with regular America? And
I think that's a separate question. I'm talking about just the narrow question, which I have long insisted, like you can't really buy an election. Money helps and your own money is in some ways easier to get and spend than other people's money. But still, you know, your Carly Fiorinas yep. and whoever else is out
think
there.
Think of
like,
Michael
you can't
Huffington.
Really...
Michael Huffington is a good example of somebody who, you know, Arianna Huffington's namesake or whatever, her first husband or second, I don't know, but he bought two terms. He bought like one or two terms
there.
As a congressman from California. He went up against Dianne Feinstein in what at the time was the most expensive Senate campaign of all time and lost. You can buy an election and you might even be able to win, you know, buy like a term or two. But if you're not actually serving anybody's interests, it's hard to stay in that. I think the other...
Yeah, California
you do appear
has
to be able to buy diplomatic.
Yeah, who gives it?
Yes. That seems to be
as you should be. God damn it.
Yeah, I mean, Obama era people, and cabinet offices too. The other thing, though, that is lurking around all of this, because Sanders came up with this too as part of that conversation, was like, oh, this is why we need fully publicly funded election campaigns where there is no private money. Everything is doled out by the state. That is truly terrifying because it is really taking tax dollars and using them in ways that are at odds with, you know, any percentage of the electorate in ways that, I mean, that would be as bad as mandating religious, taking tax money and spending it on fundamentally religious activities, I think. But also, and more importantly, all of this is happening because the means of communication has been taken away from the government and put in the hands of all sorts of types of people, whether it's Russian bots on Facebook or, you know, local activist groups that are able to get their messages out and confound all of the attempts by people like, you know, Russ Feingold and John McCain and, you know, all of the other people who come up with these supposedly foolproof ways of restricting what kinds of political speech people can make. So, you know, on top of all of the other stuff we're talking about, people who are still hammering on this issue are living in a delusional world where they think they can control political speech. Thank God that they can't, and we should stop them from trying, because that always just wreaks havoc on all sorts of free expression.
I mean, the one of the only kind of solutions offered, and there's air quotes there if you didn't hear them, to the wine cave problem, in addition to what Bernie Sanders said, was by Elizabeth Warren saying we need to overturn Citizens United, because only if we are able to make it illegal to broadcast a documentary about a political candidate between, you know, the last 2-3 months before an election, will we safely keep the billionaires out of their wine caves with their politicians? Like, it doesn't make sense. It's completely against the First Amendment. And it is, I think, a unanimous or near unanimous belief among the Democratic field right now that Roe v. Wade are the litmus tests for the Supreme Court, which is just chilling.
And it's chilling not only from the speech perspective, right? Like, you should totally be able to release a documentary about a political candidate in the lead up to an election, for crying out loud. But also, like, the wine caves always find a way. Like, they not to be like full Jeff Goldblum on y'all.
You should.
In this podcast.
No. Don't apologize for that. Please. Yeah. Go full
wine
Jeff
caves,
Goldblum.
Find a way. And I think that, you know, We've published infinity articles about this. We've made infinity videos about it. But it's really, 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 really true that even if we had publicly funded elections, even if we do any combination of any things with Citizens United, rich people will buy the time and ear of powerful people somehow. It's a thing that happens. Luckily, it doesn't actually influence our policymaking as much as people think it does. And the places where it does are places where there needs to be less power, not less richness, riches.
Yeah, I think,
havings,
you know,
the monies.
The one argument,
the lobbying on the Cromnibus
bill. The one argument about all
more
of this stuff and about the reaction to recent campaign finance restrictions and things like that. And I know, I'm pretty sure some people on this program have said it and other people I've talked to recently, but it does make the parties less powerful in who their parties nominate. Really, the main kind of casualties of McCain-Feingold and all of that kind of stuff were the official Republican and Democratic national parties. And there's an argument that, and this doesn't mean that, you know, it should be, you know, there should be more restrictions on speech, but that it has catered to extreme factions within each party. And so you have much more conservative and much more progressive candidates than you would have if the RNC and the DNC was actually more traditionally in charge of vetting and putting forward and nominating candidates within their party. And that's kind of interesting to think about.
And yet it is the so-called, the supposed moderate Pete Buttigieg who's getting hit for taking wine cave money.
I think it's the ice crystals or the Swarovski crystal chandeliers that also.
Yeah,
I like that product placement.
I was actually disappointed
Swarovski
to learn.
Was obviously, like, you know, they're paying for that. It's like Reese's Pieces.
Well,
and
do
E.T.
we know? Was it? Was it like Marianne Williamson crystals?
No, no, or it was Swarovski crystals.
Like there were chandeliers in the wine cave, or there were like natural geodes glittering in the walls? Because I really had a whole Luray Caverns vibe going
in my mind. I thought it was
going
to be like Crystal Caverns or Crystal Cave, the old video game. No, it was Swarovski chandeliers, and I've seen pictures, and it's like totally like an Eyes Wide Shut kind of, you know, elite Bohemian Grove underground, you know, Iron Mountain type scenario. Definitely Swarovski crystal chandeliers, and more power to them.
I went through, possible consideration for, you know, family movie night over here in the Welch household.
Always with the family movie
night. Eyes Wide Shut is a great
Christmas. Well, I got the in-laws in town.
It's a great Christmas.
Exactly. I started looking at, like, was it one of the best Christmas movie lists here? And Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh, and it's got the kids love it. I think it begins and ends at, like, FAO Schwartz in New York, the famous toy store. You know, come on.
Tom Hanks, like, naked, jumping up and down on the piano keys. It's
with
great.
With a little mascot.
That doesn't happen.
Before we leave the Democratic debate, Nick, you wrote a piece, The Next Dayer, a post-game analysis encouraging candidates to read Amity Schlaey's new book. What the hell are you talking about?
She's probably best known for her revisionist history of the Great Depression from about a decade ago called The Forgotten Man. She's written a book called Great Society and New History. And one of merely what it does, and she's going to be in a recent interview forthcoming. I talked to her at length about this, and the book is a wonderful narrative read, but it's not even analysis as much as it is merely reminding people that mid-60s through the early 70s, the federal government under both LBJ and then Richard Nixon undertook vast, massive spending in order to reshape every aspect of domestic policy in American life. And LBJ gave this great, you know, a speech where he said, you know, we in 1964 in Michigan at the University of Michigan, saying we have within our power to become a great society and where no child is ever hungry or uneducated or naked or unclothed, etc. Let's go and do it. And we're going to use the federal government as a means to do it. And it didn't work. It didn't work for a lot of reasons. And she goes through enormous detail to show that all of the people involved in this were incredibly well-intentioned and this stuff didn't work. And it's worth remembering that as we have, you know, as we enter a phase now, particularly among Democrats, but even under, you know, Donald Trump, there is this, you know, new weird optimism in the face of, you know, a feeling that we're living in the ash heap of history, that the federal government can snap its fingers and make everything perfect again. We have a really good demonstration project of the complexity of that and the failure of it from merely 50 years ago.
I found myself having a kind of Gene Healy Cult of the Presidency flashback PTSD in watching the Democratic debate. One of the points that he makes in both the essay that he wrote for us back in 2007 or 8 and his resulting book is that the kind of questions that you get at presidential debates or fora show a kind of sickness in the polity about, you know, people want the putative president to be their therapist, to like get in nooks and crannies that are kind of impossibly narrow and small. And the example that set me off, and this is probably due to my inherent reactionariness or something like that, but Michelle Sindor from Politico asked Bernie Sanders, I think it was, specifically what he was going to do to combat the what she described as a rise in violence against transgender women of color. And I do not mean to dismiss violence against anybody, let alone transgender women of color, but that has to be a very, very small category of human beings and also has to be a kind of a difficult thing for a president to personally do. And yet not only did no one kind of bat an eye at the question, but I just saw nothing but high fives on Twitter for what a brave and important question that Michelle Sindor asked in that moment. What are we electing a president to do here, people? And what assumptions are baked into some of those questions?
Of course,
Bernie
followed that up with a post, Matt, and I'm sure you saw this because you follow baseball Twitter, but where he was like, you know, when I'm president, Major League Baseball will never be able to break any ties with existing minor league teams, and they're going to have to pay them more league players. And it's like, you know, what about the fucking stoplight at Main and Central Avenue? You know, that's it. Come on, Bernie. It's been on the fritz for like 5 years. You know, people are dying, et cetera.
It's
like
true.
Minor league baseball. Can you imagine a freaking president of the United States, you know, being like, oh, you know, what is really important is that the Toledo Mud Hens, you know, have a good variety nut mix in the dugout. Because I'm sick and tired of these people having to have, you know, like an off-brand Chex mix, which isn't even made with real Chex cereal. You know, oh my God. It's like, you know, this is, it is insanity. It's a form of insanity. And it, and I just want to point out that this is not Donald Trump's fault. This is all pointing to the idea that he is in effect not a cause of a larger illness, which maybe going back to what
there's
Catherine
also
was saying is like maybe an outer space alien invasion would be a good thing, not because we would come together to fight it.
That is not what Catherine
because
was saying.
Because that outer space force would take over the country and actually start a bold new classical era.
No. Did you just endorse space force?
I
think we're
just
we're
want to be clear.
It.
That's not what Catherine was saying. Also, though, there's a long, proud history of federal level politicians meddling in baseball, right? Like, this is what happens when you make a sport your national pastime, is that then it becomes like a federal case. I mean, I have sepia-toned childhood memories of the various hearings about the steroids in the baseball, which were going to ruin America.
But they did.
They already did.
That's when we lost our innocence, when Roger Roger Clemens was asked whether or not he bled through his uniform, right, Matt?
Think of the children.
Yeah. Bernie is. Only Bernie is.
Think of the children. The steroids use in baseball is going to corrupt our youth.
I feel
pinball
like
machines and
comic books, pulp novels.
And
I feel like we've already
dancing.
Transitioned into the Festivus
airing of grievances. We've done
grievances
it.
Here. Nick, you are you're wearing a Seinfeld onesie as we speak, as you always do
no,
when broadcasting
thank you.
From home.
No.
What?
No, thank you.
Yeah,
for
I don't
that
even
mental
know what that means. You know, around the house, I dress almost exclusively in the Zardoz line of leisure wear.
Thanks, yes. guys. Yeah. I hate it.
You know, it's like mid thigh boots and, you know, a unidirectional diaper.
When Catherine says, I hate it, she means her job.
Yes.
Because she has to
yeah, that is like, yeah.
Nick, give
Connery's
us a
Connery's thighs were pretty hot.
No.
Give us a give us a grievance.
You know, I'm not sure. I'm actually today I started reading a book about a history of psychedelics in America, and literally I read about 5 pages in it. It's by a guy named Jesse Jarnot. It's from a couple of years ago called Heads, and it's great. And a couple of I was reading for about 5 minutes, and then I checked the news to learn that Baba Ram Dass, a.k.a. Richard Alpert, who is along with Timothy Leary, is one of the main sources of kind of psychedelic understanding, knowledge, culture in America, died. And that's my grievance, that Ram Dass, who also authored the early 70s hippie classic Be Here Now, has dead. But in another way, he was always dead. He's like Dr. Manhattan. He was always dead and he's always alive simultaneously. So my grievance is that the world is a sadder, more square place when Richard Alpert / Ram Dass transmigrates to a higher level of consciousness. But by the same token, he takes us all with us. So I'm actually on the day, the angriest day of the year, Frank Costanza's Festivus, I'm actually kind of in a wonderful space thinking about the loss and the gain that we had from knowing Ram Dass.
Be Here Now is one of my very favorite George Harrison songs, really sad. And weird 1970s songs. Peter, what is your grievance that you would like to air for us?
As I've mentioned a few times on this podcast, I recently cobbled together a kind of home theater system in my basement. It's a thing that part of a renovation that's been going on, nearly finished, but it's been going on for over a year. And so I've been, you know, I've been spending some time looking at components, in particular at speakers. And so I had decided on a pair of speakers from a British speaker manufacturer that makes really high quality speakers that are relatively, at least for the kind of thing they make, really quite affordable. The way that they do that is that instead of building their speakers in the UK, they do all the manufacturing in China. And so I had my eye on a particular pair of speakers and was going to buy them whenever things were finished with the renovation and sort of actually had a place to put them. And I went out and I tested them and the whole thing and sort of heard them and loved them. And the month that I decided to buy them, I looked at the price and suddenly the price had gone up substantially. And I called the manufacturer and talked to one of their sales reps, and he didn't say specifically the words that the trade war, but he said something about like supply chain cost increases or something like this. Trump's trade war drove the price of these speakers up. And it made me really mad because it cost me extra money.
This is a great classic Festivus grievance. It is perfect.
Because speaker prices don't go up, they go down. And in fact, I have another pair of speakers from this company that has come down in price, first on some sales and then just dropped in price. And it's a great pair of speakers. And it has come down over the years. I've been following this company's prices, right? Just sort of had a sense of what was going on. There was no chance that these speakers were going to get more expensive. But because they're made in China, in order to make them more affordable and easier to make, and because Trump has a trade war that is making this stuff that is making it much more expensive to import goods from China into the United States and changing those supply lines, it's making home theater speakers more expensive and costing me money. There's a subwoofer company, I believe from Ohio, SVS, that I've also read recently is saying basically that by the end of the year, if the trade stuff hasn't calmed down, they're going to end up having to raise their speaker prices as well. These things have practical impacts on your actual life. You should be upset.
Catherine, what subwoofers are you airing your grievances towards?
So I'm going to disappoint you by not having grievances. I'm sorry, but
wow.
I am super filled with Christmas joy lately because of the random gifts that have been showing up at the Reason offices from our readers. You guys, it is like seriously making me a little like warm-hearted and squishy. We have gotten weed. We have gotten chocolate. We have gotten a bunch of cool swag from a space mission, from a rocket launch, including one of those like cool challenge coins that like, I don't really understand what they're for, but they're really cool.
Drinking.
And
we've gotten booze.
We've gotten
some monk beer.
Monk beer. We have gotten other booze. We have gotten a signed copy of Neal Stephenson's book that I will not shut up about and that Peter will not shut up about.
Slightly jealous of this.
By a reader signed to me personally. Like, it's just beautiful. It's so nice. This is not actually a veiled pitch to send more gifts. It's truly not.
I think it's a naked pitch.
This has not really happened. It has not really happened in past years. It's just been like a real 12 days of Christmas around
this
here.
This is the most enthusiastic I think I might ever have seen you about stuff.
I know.
Because normally
I like throwing stuff away.
Stuff
mostly
is like, oh, I don't really want to have things.
Yeah. No, I mostly get enthusiastic about the disposal of stuff. But like this stuff isn't stuff, Peter. It's love.
I'm shocked and appalled that on an airing of the grievances, two out of the three of you went positive. Although I appreciate the O. Henry twist at the end.
Yeah, I assume you bring it home with a classic,
that
Matt.
An enlarged heart. Catherine's heart grew three sizes that day and exploded.
I did watch The Grinch. Rewatch The Grinch
up.
Yesterday.
The Jim Carrey
still
version.
Holding
no,
up.
The cartoon
the Jim
monster
Carrey version where he does the Sean Connery accent thread.
Whatever the reason, my heart or my shoes, I stood here on Christmas Eve hating the Who's. But
you know what I want to see is the Dr. Seuss, the war.
Of course you have that memorized. She's not reading
that. The wartime version of the Grinch Who Stole Christmas. Matt, it's probably got some Japanese caricatures.
Oh, my.
No.
I just want to point out, I watched that yesterday, too, I think, Catherine, or the day before, for the annual viewing. And I think it's really basically a parable of Democratic politics.
Ooh.
Because the Grinch is celebrated
for
stealing all of your stuff
and then redistributing
it to you.
Matt, this isn't Hannity.
Like, oh,
are you in a fugue state? You think you're on Hannity again or something?
Yeah.
Why don't you throw a midget football
to the
audience?
No, the Grinch is great. Long live the Grinch. Mm-hmm. My airing of the grievances goes out there to the new TradCons and their interminable 2019 Year of the Manifesto. You know who I'm talking about out there. It's you, Sohrab Amari. I think I almost pronounced that correct this time. James Polos, Roger Ahare, Pascal Emmanuel Gobry, Daniel McCarthy, James Antle, all you people at Claremont. You can't stop writing manifestos. You're against the dead consensus. You have, and this is a headline, and don't laugh out loud, you have a science-based case for ending the porn epidemic. Let's dwell on that for a second. Just the headline. You've got a tech new deal you people are manifestoing about. Stop it! I totally appreciate the gesture, and this is sincere, and some of these people I've been friendly with over the years and am to this day. I appreciate the gesture of trying to fill in what is kind of a new either ideology or just like filling out the details of what one would hope after the kind of Trump meteor into the swamp of American politics or global politics and sketching things out and arguing ideas. All of that is actually to the good because it gets things out there. Of course, every single one of these is basically an attack on / complete overestimation of or over whatever valuing of the libertarian pernicious libertarian influence on the world. That's fine. You're not going to have to agree. People don't agree, libertarians, whatever. But just there's a pomposity to manifestos in general. They're right there next to like the open letter and the proposed speech to the president before the State of the Union. These are classics of bad writing and a lack of kind of self-awareness, right, of what you're doing. And what a lot of what you're doing, in addition to looking for and sketching out new ideologies and ideas and things like that, which is all to the good. But part of this is you're kind of leaning into where you think and hope and kind of gleefully expect power is going. You are reacting to power as much as you are reacting to the new ideas that are fermenting in your brain. And meanwhile, you're writing a lot of pompous manifestos that I have to read to the end because of my job. So that's my grievance.
Do you want to move directly into the feats of strength then, Matt?
Do you want to sign my open letter against manifestos?
Against
we demand
Orrin
an
Cass.
End to demands.
Yes.
I'm posting it at Pornhub. I think that's the place where these TradCon
the final home of free speech once all the TradCons have their
There's
way.
There's now a stepsister / TradCon channel at Pornhub.
Oh, Catherine, you love your job. I feel like we've been doing it anyways, but let's just keep with the tradition and go to our end of podcast consumption. I'll start since I already ended the last one, which is that I consumed greedily, happily, and hungrily for the first time a entire episode of Saturday Night Live while it was happening because basically hashtag okay boomer or okay Gen Xer. Eddie Murphy was his era of Saturday Night Live is exactly when I was kind of old enough to be allowed to stay up that late. And the way that he rescued that show and that he was just amazing in 1982 when he hosted the damn thing, I wanted to watch it. I watched it and it was great. It was just great. There were some parts that weren't that great, but the Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood about gentrification is hilarious. And the very last segment on the entire program, the one which is always the worst, was hilarious, like absolutely funny. He's a very anarchic kind of funny live performer, and they subverted a lot of discussion about race and politics. It was great. I loved it. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
So my project of 2019, which has been, I think I can safely say, a failure, has been to try and like find commonality and empathy for olds. Because, you know, we're in the middle of a big, dumb generational warfare and we're all like, OK, boomer, and everything's bad. And my olds and my family are getting older. And so I was like, OK, I gotta figure out how to build a bridge to the past or
you
something.
You need a Christmas Day truce, right?
Yeah.
Like,
so,
go play soccer in no man's land.
Anyway, I mostly failed. But,
I
have been applying this. I have been applying this to Joe Biden this week because I read the piece that everybody read, or if they didn't, they should, which is the Atlantic story about Joe Biden as a stutterer. And it is really good. It's a really good essay. It's called What Joe Biden Can't Bring Himself to Say. And it's written by a stutterer about Joe Biden's struggle with his stutter. And, you know, without giving spoilers here, the very, very interesting thing about this piece. Yeah. Well, so it's the piece has a little bit of a twist, which I am going to like semi-spoil. But Joe Biden genuinely believes that he doesn't stutter anymore, that he is a fully recovered stutterer, or at least that's what he says and has said in public for decades. But if you listen to him talk, and according to this author, especially if you listen to him talk as a stutterer yourself, you hear that he is a high-functioning stutterer, that he actually has all kinds of classic coping mechanisms that stutterers use, circumlocution and word switching and all kinds of other stuff, and that sometimes he just straight-up stutters. And that the reason this piece is kind of appearing now and why it feels important is because it is mixing the signal on how old and confused Joe Biden is versus he's just a stutterer. And once you have that filter and you listen to him talk with that filter on, it actually, like, I would say
so
I mentally raised. He still sucks, but he doesn't suck in this specific way that I previously thought that he that might have kind of genuinely disqualified him from the presidency. I thought he was getting a little demented and old and confused. And that, I think, is not really what's going on, or at least is not only what's going on. And it's a very good piece to kind of look at someone who you've been staring at for a long time already with fresh eyes and see something important about them, even if they can't see it about themselves.
As someone who proudly refused to read that article.
You feel sorry now because it's a good
piece? I'm deeply suspicious. I'm just suspicious that we learned this.
Oh, you think it's a
in
plan.
His fifth yeah. decade in public office,
well,
right as people are
talking
about this
the
thing.
The article, you would see the long thread of actual evidence and discussion, and he appears at these stuttering conferences and he does all these things. It's just that his narrative is I fixed it, and the reality is he didn't.
Matt,
which
what do you
will
think
also be
when,
the narrative of
when
his
Biden
presidency
loses Iowa and New Hampshire, what revelation will come out that he was born with Ooh. Like no kidneys or something? What, because
he's trans.
Yeah. Yeah,
he's transhuman at this point, right? He's mostly
he is transhuman. He's actually Zoltan Istvan has been dressing up as Joe Biden at these debates this
if
entire
only.
Time.
It's part of that would be the best ending to this story.
Speaking of Zoltan Istvan, Peter, what have you been consuming?
I watched Rise of the Skywalker. I didn't like it. It was bad. But what I really want to talk about is
Baby Yoda
Marriage Story on Netflix, which is Noah Baumbach's movie. Basically about his own divorce. Noah Baumbach also made The Squid and the Whale about his parents' divorce. And it's just a great, humane, funny, literary kind of piece of filmmaking that is the sort of thing that that doesn't get made anymore, except it does. And Netflix is making it. Netflix is giving weird, interesting filmmakers money to make passion projects and to make little, small human dramas that work really well and are just marvelously engaging and incredibly well acted and written. And I highly recommend it, especially if you're the sort of person who took me and Catherine up on our recommendation from earlier this year and read Fleshman Is in Trouble. This is, in a lot of ways, a kind of partner to that, because it's another story about a successful East Coast couple in their, you know, sort of hitting middle age and splitting up.
Are you guys turning into the Mika and Joe of Reason?
Bite your tongue.
Yeah, maybe, but if so, I'm Mika.
Well, you got the gams, Peter. Not gonna lie,
Nick.
Unlike
save us
Sean
from
Connery.
Yourself.
I take it back. I do have
out,
a grievance.
to actually continue to regress back into the womb in some way, I am going to recommend seeing the Shia LaBeouf movie Honey Boy, which is out in theaters. Probably it may already be gone by now, but it is a really fun and interesting movie by one of America's most recent and great child stars, who then morphed into a young adult movie star who did everything possible to destroy his career and has come back as both an actor and a author of this screenplay. And it's about a child actor and his tormented relationship with his father. If you are into the baseball and sports world horrors of, you know, fathers and sons competing with each other, you know, the Pete Reiser story or Fear Strikes Out, Jimmy Pearsall, all of that kind of stuff. Todd Maranovich, who I suspect Matt Welch borrowed half mesh football jerseys from sometime growing up. It's got all that as well as a bunch of acting stuff. It's a good movie, and it was quite interesting. And again, it's also kind of fascinating to see an actor in real life kind of trying to mature and doing it in fits and starts. I highly recommend it.
That's very nice. Okay, that wraps up this edition of the Reason Roundtable podcast. Happy Festivus, everyone. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah, all of which sort of, it's like it happens at the same time every year. It's strange. But thanks for listening. We're going to do a New Year's Eve podcast, or close to it, as well next Monday. So sit still for that. And also make sure to go to reason.com/podcasts and subscribe to our other stuff, which is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum debates. Thanks again. See you next week.